generous in your spirit. Good night.
This is Eric Anderson.
This is Wolsey Clements.
You're tuned to WBAI.
What's up, ladies and gentlemen? This is LL Cool J.
This is Dave Marsh.
Hi, this is Tony Bennett.
Hi, this is Julie Cruz from New York City, and you're listening to
WBAI FM.
The soundtrack of New York City.
Non-commercial and with no additives. We're listener-supported.
I don't listen to the radio.
I don't like stuff that sucks.
You talking to me?
I love this radio station.
You talking to me?
12 midnight here at WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, streaming live at WBAI.org. Coming up in 90 minutes, Jim Freund, Hour of the Wolf, Science Fiction Radio, followed by Lister, burning that flag at 3 a.m. with music and interesting chat. But right now, as we present every midnight, Wednesday evening into Thursday morning, it is time for Earthwatch with Robert Knight. Please stay tuned.
Things of which I'm most proud, it really has to be...
That is, if we can get the equipment to play along. Let's try that again.
On today's Earthwatch, we'll hear Robert Knight's prophetic interview featuring Scott Portzine, a nuclear security expert and representative with Three Mile Island Alert, in which they cover the issues concerning the Iranian civilian nuclear energy program, WikiLeaks, and domestic insecurity. The program originally broadcast in 2010. In segment two, we hear a talk by Robert Knight at the inaugural Peace Action Conference with Volunteers for Peace in 2011. In the final segment, we revisit the Pete Seeger performance for the New York City Mayoral Forum at Cooper Union. It was originally broadcast on the 5 o'clock shadow in March of 2013. The forum was moderated by Robert Knight.
For freedom still rings. The bell for freedom still rings. Sorrow to me, but does it ring to know the bell of freedom still rings? The hammer for justice still pounds. The hammer for justice still pounds. Stop and see. When will we feel what we've been missing? That the man in the moon must have found. 'Cause he looks upon us with a frown. To know that millions of babies still starve. means a baby still starves. We can't have the biggest heart if means a baby still starves. And the innocent one still died. The innocent one still died. We can't value life too high if the innocent one still dies. When will the world stop enlisting? When will we all stop and see? Cause he looks upon us with a frown. Light of truth we won't let shine. Light of truth we won't let shine. Tell me, has the world gone blind? Light of truth we won't let shine. As long as there's life, there's still a day. There's life, there's still a day. And I know that we can find our way. For as long as there's life, there's still a day.
Stephen Morris with our theme song here today on Earthwatch on WBAI 99.5 and WBAI.org on the web. My name is Robert Knight. This is our concluding program for the year 2010, and what a year it has been, one with deceptions in terms of the executive administration, with the promise of the reduction, but the fact of the increase of war. It has been a year of revelation, with WikiLeaks bringing a Promethean understanding of the true machinations of the foreign policy of the United States. It's been a year that saw the worst pollution of a body of water by oil pirates in the history of the United States. It saw the tragedy of the Haitian earthquake and the regripping of that nation by economic and military interests. We've seen the unreliability of the claim of democratic liberation in so many countries around the world. And we have seen the issue of energy intertwined with that of data. We saw a most unusual virus unleashed, ostensibly by agencies with great resources of unknown identity, releasing a virus, a Trojan horse called Stuxnet, that some people think were designed to disable the operations of the nation of Iran in what they insist is a civilian nuclear energy program. Someone familiar with that and so many other subjects is our first guest tonight, Scott Portzein, who you probably have seen on various media, including CNN, ABC, Dateline, and so on. He is a nuclear security expert. He is with Three Mile Island Alert. Three Mile Island is where this radio station cut its teeth on the no nukes issue and on the hazards to the environment thereof. And it's an honor to have you with us here tonight, Scott. Welcome to Earthwatch.
Thank you, Robert. My hat's off to you for being on top of this subject for years.
My God. Well, thank you. I mean, I just did what seemed to come naturally as an investigative journalist, to look deeper than the propaganda of the industries and the mainstream media.
Yeah, there's quite a bit of financing going on behind the scenes to create a new nuclear renaissance, as they say. but it's turning out to be a mirage, and companies are walking away from their plans, selling some of their assets, dropping plans for new types of reactors, for instance, the pebble bed reactor. A couple of years ago, that was dropped. That was supposed to be a numerical reactor that was reported in Popular Science magazine, and a professor from MIT, Kadak, and of course Kadak turned out to be a nuclear profiteer, as I like to call him, and he's no longer working strictly as on the scholarly level, but he's promoting the resurgence of the nuclear energy. The pebble bed reactor, by the way, most people don't know this, had an accident 9 days after Chernobyl in Germany. There was another small nuclear accident at an experimental pebble bed reactor. The biggest problem with the pebble bed reactor is it relies upon perfect fuel pebbles. These are about the size of a tennis ball. No one has ever made one single perfect pebble for the pebble bed reactor, and they need about 100,000 of these in each reactor.
How is this different from the piles and the graphite rods that we know as a traditional fission reactor?
Well, the moderator, or the graphite in this case, is wrapped around the fuel, and that's the coating over that tennis ball. And they can't make that coating perfect. There's always a crack in it. There's always a flaw in it. They've never made one single one that didn't have a flaw.
Balloon go pop.
Well, that's what happens. They jam up, and it was a recycling type situation where it was like burning pellets of fuel in a wood stove type burner, and they circulated from top to bottom and then had to go back up to the top. Well, they jammed up, and then the graphite can catch on fire and release radiation, and that's what happened in Germany.
Our guest is Scott Portzein, and already you have advanced the plot with your comments about the so-called new containment technology. But Scott, I'd like to back up to a wider angle here just for a moment, because President Obama, during the year 2010, made an announcement that, well, I guess it was a myth on top of a myth, when he said, in order to reduce our dependence on foreign oil, and I don't know what oil is foreign to the planet Earth, that we're going to renew our commitment to nuclear energy. And here in the transition of years, I'd like you to take your time and assess whether that is a viable strategy and what truly is happening with the nuclear industry today.
Okay. Well, first of all, our energy dependence, oil dependence, I should say, has nothing to do with nuclear. Nuclear creates electricity in this country. Only 2%, less than 2% of the electricity generated in the United States comes from oil, and that is in Hawaii. And two-thirds of that comes from, they get their oil from Asia. So there again, two-thirds of that small percentage is foreign oil that's producing that electricity. There's another myth that I'd like to have people come to grips with. They talk about we must end our dependence on foreign oil, and as you say, it's everybody's oil, so to speak, the planet's oil, and that not only do we steal it, rob it, and create economies with it and dollar values with it, but we pollute each other with it also. If we, in fact, as a nation, strategically decided to use up our oil supplies that we are claiming is ours, then we really are over the barrel when we have run out of oil. That's if you believe that oil is a finite source. There's a lot of new information in recent years that says oil is not a finite source, that it is a geological process that creates oil, not from fossil plants, fossilized plants and so forth. So when we hear politicians say about we're going to end our dependency on foreign oil, that will never be a strategic military or economic plan for the United States. No gaming, no war gamer, no military strategist will ever say, yeah, let's use all of ours first, and then we'll try to get some later from another hostile country, let alone a friendly country, too. So I don't think people should get all excited about ending our dependence on foreign oil with nuclear, because we can do all of our energy. I'm getting ahead of myself. I'm going to come back to what you're saying. We can supply all of our energy through wind, solar, water, and off the top of my head, yeah, wind, water, and solar. That's the only three we need. And there's a Scientific American article from November of last year that was really good, describing that plan. And we'll talk about that a little bit later. But what has happened in the nuclear realm, Obama's been pressured to continue this nuclear resurgence, and there's military reasons to do that. Every single nuclear program in the world feeds its weapons program. That's where they get some of the nuclear materials, the special nuclear materials, the plutonium, the deuterium and the tritium, and some of the boosters that they can literally dial a yield with these nuclear missiles, where they control how much boosting goes on by adding these gases to the blend, so to speak. And so nuclear power is a military asset and a military problem everywhere. And, of course, this is what we're seeing right now, especially in Iran and in North Korea. And so with the pressures comes the feasibility of the economics, and economics are totally against nuclear power. In Pennsylvania, nuclear energy costs more than any of the other traditional powers until recently. Wind was more expensive, but now wind is cheaper than nuclear. So we were always told that nuclear power is clean, cheap, and safe. And the safety record certainly can be argued, and it carries bigger risk than any other form of power, that's for sure. But it's never been clean, and it has a very special pollutant, and costs a lot of money to take care of that type of pollutant. And so what has happened economically, the industry has asked and pressured the government and the military through the indirect connection there for loan agreements that they did not want to spend up front $8 to $10 to $12 billion to construct one nuclear plant, and that they knew it was a financial risk. Wall Street would have nothing to do with it. Wall Street runs away with the nuclear, away from people planning nuclear. And so in order to go through with it, the government said, well, we'll have to guarantee some of these loans, and they're trying to milk the taxpayers for $32 to $50 billion to get the first round of nuclear plants started. And ratepayers in Florida and South Carolina are already paying an increase in their rates, even though the plants aren't under construction yet. They've started to till the ground, so to speak, but nothing has been built, and they've already spent $1 billion in each state.
Scott, what you're saying actually has some hope within it. It's the first discussion I've had involving nuclear power that had that component.
Well, yeah, it falls apart under its own weight. It's a technology that requires so much rocket science and follow-up that they can't do it feasibly. It's like the pursuit of fusion. Right now, we don't understand enough science to create a fusion reaction, which would be a great way to go. Fusion, by the way, uses hydrogen and helium and the elements that only have a couple of electrons. And the dangerous ones, the radioactive ones, are at the other end of the spectrum, the uranium and the plutonium, the thorium, the strontium, cobalt, and these types of things.
So small is green is good.
Yeah, in this particular case, yes.
Even in the atomic realm. Scott, one of the things that we have discussed in the past is the junction between nuclear technology and data technology. You and I have spoken in the past about Insidious virus, Trojan horse, called Stuxnet, which popped on the scene with what appeared to be tremendous undisclosed resources for its creation, that by all analysts, and we spoke with the security director of Symantec about this, Liam Amirchu, called Stuxnet, which appear to be targeted against either the nuclear facility or the fuel processing facilities of the data mechanical machines that create the process for safely producing fuel and the atomic energy reactions and so on. And I would be remiss not to ask you, what is your latest understanding of the issue of Stuxnet?
Yeah, they've really had a problem in Iran now. We just learned in the last few days that 1,000 of the 10,000 centrifuges have been destroyed from this virus. And what would happen, these rotors have to spin very rapidly, and the Stuxnet virus took over the microprocessors. It's a microcomputer that sends electronic signals and frequencies for these motors to drive these rotors. And it would spin them too fast or oscillate between a proper setting and a very high setting until it destroyed the motors by destroying bearings or just falling apart, and maybe even the seals, I'm supposing. So some scientists, cyber scientists, originally thought that the purpose of the Stuxnet virus was to secretly cause the uranium enrichment process to be flawed without destroying the rotors, without destroying the machinery, and that it would hide and just constantly stop the Iranians, halt their process.
A poison pill that would give back bad data about the purity of the process and then cause later problems?
That they would never be able to figure it out. But now that they've discovered, they think 1,000 of the centrifuges were destroyed, they're rethinking what the Stuxnet has done. Incidentally, I read an article today in Popular Mechanics, and it said how easy it is to get rid of the Stuxnet virus with these industrial-grade antivirus software. Boy, couldn't that be farther from the truth. The Iranians have been infected with 62,000 machines have been infected, and there's experts saying if they don't absolutely get rid of those machines, they'll just continue to reinfect themselves. On the 16th of November, the Bushehr nuclear processing plant finally shut down all of its centrifuges because they just were not having success. It was continually deteriorating, as if the virus, it indicates to some people that the virus was still spreading. And there's cybersecurity experts that believe that they will have problems with this for years, and that they will absolutely have to clean house of all their computers and make disconnects from all their suppliers and contractors, and it's just going to be a mess. But see, it's not going to stop there. Of course, if it's that bad, then it's already hit other nations, including ours. And so we don't know what the end results are going to be with this, and we don't know what some clever hackers are going to do now that they understand more about that code and can obtain it and information about that code.
Our guest is Scott Portzine, and he is nuclear security expert. He is with Three Mile Island Alert. Among his many appearances have been CNN, ABC, Dateline, and the United States Congress. Am I correct?
Yes, that's right. That was written testimony. I've testified in person to many other committees, but in 1993 I provided written testimony about how easy it was to attack a United States nuclear plant using publicly available documents, and that the documents should be available, but that security needed to be improved. We have a right to be critical of safety concerns and risks that are associated with businesses that are in our area that we live. What other industry has the ability to wipe out my entire state, making it unlivable, ruining trillions of dollars in economics? So I think citizens need to be at the meetings and need to have the documents and need to educate themselves so they know how to insist on changes and try to get these people to do the right thing. And that's really becoming difficult lately.
Scott, there's another area that I feel we must explore together, and I think the Stuxnet was the fulcrum of transitioning from the nuclear debate to the technotronic, the cyber debate. And in some of our conversations, I've raised the question, and I think you're sensitive to my concern, that I've been immersed in the beautiful revelations, the Promethean fire brought to the citizens about the behavior of their government, ostensibly on their behalf, through the State Department with the WikiLeaks most recent release of so many things where policy is the opposite of publicity. And this brings us to the real nexus of next year's and next century's challenge about information. Because the dissemination of the WikiLeaks is so highly dependent upon the Internet, which, of course, I presume everyone knows was originally a Pentagon invention from DARPANET, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. It became a common carrier. It became part of the commonweal as it went from science to being civilianized. It became a route for commerce. And with the freedom of transmissions implicit in that, it became temporarily, before advertising took over, a liberationist tool. And among the fruits of that has been WikiLeaks, many other things as well. And now what we're seeing are several levels of attack about that freedom of information. We've been seeing institutional attacks with the denial of service attacks on the WikiLeaks website, but more insidious than that, the economic and political attacks on economic common carriers like Visa and MasterCard and Amazon and PayPal, all of which bowed to government pressure and tried to cut off the legal defense fund of co-founder Julian Assange. And it seems to me, Scott, that we are in a new, nuclear battleground of freedom of information. And here's my key question to you. The enforcement, as we've learned through WikiLeaks, the strong-arming of the government of Spain, of the United Kingdom, by the United States under the false flag of the recording industry, the U.S. played some hardball and made Spain and England and other countries submit to tracking Internet addresses, of gathering maximum data of permanent identification of individuals and tracking what they download. Now, ostensibly, that's to do digital rights management, copyright of music. You know, this is when you share, you're unfair, you know. But I have a more ominous suspicion that if the United States government and its agencies can engage in operations to shut down peer-to-peer networks, to do denial-of-service attacks, to attack WikiLeaks, and prevent people from downloading the insurance file from WikiLeaks. If they can stop records, they can stop other freedoms of information. And here's the big question for tonight, Scott Portzine. If the USG, United States government, can use commercial copyright as a false flag to shut down, monitor, or otherwise freeze the Internet, do you fear that they might have an intention of preventing us from getting files such as insurance.aes256, of being able to share the wealth of information from the revelation of WikiLeaks? Do you see anything deeper and darker on the horizon?
Oh, yeah. The government of the world are going to demand some accuracy. It'll be so bad that you will not be able to log on to your computer without your thumbprint or your eye scan. And then there'll be another series of security checks that you'll have to go through, maybe voice recognition and several numbers and more than just your high school and your first car, you know, that kind of stuff. And that there'll probably be three separate internets. And then there'll be secret ones beyond that we'll never know about for years. And that...
Pardon me for interrupting. One of the things I love learning from the WikiLeaks is CIPRNet, secret internet protocol maintained by the Pentagon. I had not known of that before.
I'd never heard of the name of it, but I've known that it existed. And, yeah, there's high-speed, very high-speed internets where it's 100 times faster than anything we have now. But I do foresee a time where you will be personally held responsible for everything that you download, read, or disseminate from your computer, and that they will instantly know who has done it, because you will have to log on with your thumbprint and so forth. And they will shut down quite a bit of information in the future, and at least the fear of being caught will become tremendous. And so they might actually segregate the Internet into regions where one thing that makes it hard to find cyber hackers these days is the amount of computers they go through around the world before they hit the one they want to attack can be, in the dozens. So if they break down regions and you can't get out of your regions without your papers, like you're traveling in the former Soviet bloc, you're not going to go anywhere they don't want you to go. And I really think that's going to happen someday, because they can't come up with enough security to clog all the holes that exist now and will be created in the future. After all, if you're going to have computers communicate to each other, there has to be at least one hole somewhere, and hackers will always be able to exploit that hole. So they'll have to go to another technique, and I think it's going to be draconian. I have personal experience with the overreaction of government to information on the Internet, and that happened, I guess that was about the year 2004. And if you Google my name at CNN, you'll see an article there called Blueprint for Terrorists. And we, meaning me and a few other nuclear activists, saw that the NRC was providing too much information from a database that anyone could access from their home computer that showed where dangerous nuclear materials were located in universities and hospitals, not only what the address was, but what floor, what room, what closet, what shelf, what drawer, and so forth. And it even described what security may or may not have existed at that building. So we have been pressuring the NRC to get rid of that particular page or two in each one of those reports, and there were hundreds of them, and they said, no, it's not necessary. Finally, NBC was about to air a report based on my research that evening, and the NRC shut down its entire database. It wiped out or eliminated access to hundreds of thousands of documents that deserved to be in the hands of the public, as I said earlier, for safety reasons and concerns, and for us to look over their shoulder, be sure that they are doing their jobs properly. And they pulled everything off. So, there were a few people who were critical of me for causing that problem. They did reinstate the database. It took about 6 months, but they purged those particular pages and not the whole document. And that was the proper way to handle that. But when you think about the reaction that's going to come from hundreds of agencies, not just one federal agency, the NRC, it's going to be draconian. And so what they're going to probably have to do is identify who each user is, and you're not going to go anywhere unless they can identify you.
That's my friend, our guest, Scott Portsine. And you started out so optimistically about the decline of nuclear energy as a policy solution. And here we are. Scott, I thank you so much for taking the time that you have so far, knowing your commitments in the morning. I have my own as well. But let me just bring this to a close by asking you to take a blue sky and say whatever you want. Our theme tonight is about a happier and more peaceful new year. What retro observations or what guideposts do you see for the next year?
Well, the good news is that the Department of Energy's plan for 20% of the electricity being provided by wind power by the year 2030 is going well. We're ahead of schedule for that. And if you look at the article I was talking about in Scientific American, or go to the Stanford University's website and read about their energy planning and what they have studied, they're saying that we can get all of our energy, not only the supply business and your home, but your vehicle, from wind, water, and solar power by the year 2030. Because let's face it, there is far more energy coming into this Earth from the sun, which is also wind power, by the way, than we can possibly use. So if we can tap into that and convert it to the energy and distribute it the way we need to, we will solve a lot of economic problems. We will create jobs. We'll cut down on pollution. We'll cut down on the need to pay an endless nuclear waste bill that will go on longer than we've had recorded history. And it just solves a lot of problems. So that's the good news. We're on the way to doing that. The technologies are actually here now. There's a few things that they need to resolve with some of the materials for the wind turbines to make them work better. But they don't need, you know, there's all these myths out there about, oh, if we covered the planet with, you know, the whole United States with wind turbines, it still wouldn't be enough. It's just not true. And so all of that's in that article and the studies you can read about and overcome a lot of these beliefs that the anti-alternative energy people spout. And I think that's kind of a strange label that you don't hear, anti-alternative energy. But they call people who are against nuclear power anti-nuclear or anti-nukes. Why would anybody be against alternative energy? And it's sustainable energy. It's renewable energy. It's clean. It gives power to the people instead of to the oil companies.
Scott, how can people keep track of your work? Scott Portzein is a very important man who's been seen on ABC, CNN, and many other places, including the United States Congress. He's a nuclear security expert. He is also with Three Mile Island Alert. You're one of the, that organization is one of the elders of our wisdom today. And how can people keep track of your work?
Well, we do have a website, www.tmia.com. You can read the current things that are going on there.
Well, thank you. You have been brilliant, and I look forward to our next encounter. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Robert.
Scott Portzein, right. My hero. This is Earthwatch on WBAI in New York or WBAI.org on the web. My name is Robert Knight.
Come gather around, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. And if your breath to you is worth saving, then you'd better start swimming, or you'll sink like a stone. For the times, they are a-changin'. Come writers and critics who prophesize with your pen, and keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again. And don't speak too soon, 'cause the wheel is still in spin, and there's no telling who it's naming. For the loser now will later to win, for the time they are a-changing. Come senators, congressmen, please heed the call. Don't stand in the doorway, don't block up the hall. For he that gets hurt will be he who has stalled. There's a battle outside and it's raging. It'll soon shake your windows and rattle your walls. For the time they are mothers and fathers throughout the land, and don't criticize what you can't understand. Your sons, your daughters are beyond your command. it is cast. The slow now will be later fast, as the present now will be later past. The order is rapidly fading, and the first one now that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. And if your breath to you is worth saving, then you'd better start swimming, or you'll sink like a stone. All the times they are better start swimming, or you'll sink like a stone. All the times they are a change.
This is the first annual Peace Action Conference at the Lamar Peace and Justice Center. This is the inaugural event. Robert's energy is inspirational. He's one of those people that you can pass by on the street or in an office, and it just looks like he is moving with a very, very serious purpose in mind. I am happy to know him and learn more every time we have a conversation. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Robert Knight.
Thank you. Thank you. One of my brightest new colleagues, Andrew Bell. And grateful to be here with my colleagues, Kathy, Andrew, Grayson, Ken, Crystal, and all the rest of you, Workers for Peace. I could not say no to an invitation to work with Volunteers for Peace, and fortunate to be here through the auspices of the Half Moon Foundation, Beth Lamont and her eternal great work for peace, WBAI, of course. And it struck me in preparing today that Volunteers for Peace and the Pacifica Foundation have very similar core principles: to understand and thereby remove the causes of war and other conflicts, to mitigate the effects of war, and to seek peace and understanding among the various nations and people of this earth. So I do not feel that I'm visiting different people. I feel quite at home right here now today. Those of you involved in the work of Volunteers for Peace are involved in traveling to distant places. It's a mission that requires a great deal of courage and even more love. Love of life, and the courage to defy a growing policy of war being conducted in your name, a policy of repression and of environmental destruction. The operations of the United States Department of Defense, the so-called Pentagon, are the single largest contributor to global warming, carbon dioxide, and greenhouse gases, from all of the aircraft and ground transportation needed to maintain the various illegal and undeclared wars on this planet. Some years ago, there was an apocryphal story about a pacifist who was attacked by a Neanderthal ancestor of today's Fox News. A reactionary misanthrope who called himself a real American. And this fella said to the pacifist, "America, you should love it or leave it." Well, my friends, I think you have found the way to both love it and leave it. in your great work for peace around the world. There's a joke that's a favorite of mine in a more modern day. A similar kind of peaceful person was asked, you know, if you don't like America, why don't you go somewhere else? Basically the same admonition. And this person answered, well, I'm not going to leave America because I don't want to be a victim of its foreign policy. As you go abroad, you will not be the victim but the transformer of American policy, because many people of the world are more intelligent about the truth of the American people and the divergence of the American government from those goals. So give yourselves a hand for taking on this great mission. You are needed more than any moment in history, because there will also be other Americans abroad. There will be covert pilots in Yemen pretending to fly under the cover of the government uniform there. There will be tens of thousands of sailors and Marines in Bahrain, one of the largest U.S. military bases abroad, there as well as in Qatar and Doha, where the United States is setting up operations for ongoing devilment of the Central Command, and in Somalia, and nearby places where the current administration is hoping to set up an Africa Command to take control of Nigerian oil, to have gunboat diplomacy, to make sure that the offshore discoveries get transited here, much like the rearrangement of Libyan oil in recent days. There will be tens of thousands of Americans at SAS and French Foreign Legionnaires in the Libyan Arab Jamahiriya, where even as we speak, there are being conducted, much like the days of civil rights, lynchings of Afro-Libyans and expulsion of guest workers of a darker hue, and their disappearances and extrajudicial deprivation of life. As we speak, the Cyrenaicans, who are supportive of this racism, and the shameful president and other world leaders who have yet to explicitly condemn these practices, will continue in their hopes of enacting bitter policies for sweet crude. As you go out in this world of war today, you'll be witness to the attempted overthrow of one of Africa's most developed nations, ahead of Brazil and Russia in the World Development Index, a primary co-founder and supporter of the African Union, an organization that would have helped establish an African dinar to compete with the euro and the American dollar, which, as a currency for the exchange of oil, makes possible the support and maintenance of U.S. military escapades abroad. All of this is done without a constitutional declaration of war. It is done by media and supported by our ignorance against which you are fighting as workers for peace. It pains me to sit here in the presence of those working for peace and civil rights to realize that it took a black president to overthrow an African nation. Brings me nearly to tears, except that we know the measure of a soul is not in what one says, but what one does. Barack Obama read it wrong. He thought the admonition was say the right thing. And yet, Barack Obama has placed twice as many troops, more than twice as many troops, in an endless war in Afghanistan that has brought neither peace, security, nor victory. As if America would walk bold out of the centuries and do what no one has ever done before. So you're not going to be the only Americans abroad in your work as volunteers for peace. U.S. occupation in Iraq intends to be permanent. There, where a million people have died through starvation, bombing, and other military operations over the years, they will remain. The American combat troops in Iraq will be born again, as it were. They will be rebaptized in the waters of war. They will be baptized and given a new name of trainers. And half of them will remain skulking around the dark corner called Kuwait while they maintain hundreds of bases in Iraq and support an embassy that is larger even than the Holy See. You've got some work in front of you. Like the Afghanistan again and again war, Pakistan, where marriages are murdered by missiles, and drones are used as a fig leaf to avoid the confrontation of the lack of declaration of war for all of these adventures. Hostilities, all of which are disguised by the purported safety for American killers of remote control drone warfare. Your work is cut out for you as peacemakers in this world of undeclared war. Your lives, even, are no longer guaranteed by the possession of your passport. President Barack Obama recently committed murder, an extrajudicial deprivation of life, with the killing of a man named Anwar al-Awlaki. This issue is not new. 7 years ago, before the United States Supreme Court, another father with a child who engaged in radical, perhaps revolutionary, perhaps even seditious activities, questioned whether the executive branch had the right or the power to simply decide somebody should be dead without due process. And much to our surprise, it was Justice Scalia who, in a dissent to the Supreme Court decision supporting such policies, said, where the government accuses a citizen of waging war against it, our constitutional tradition has been to prosecute him or her in federal court for treason or some other crime. Terrorism is not a crime. It is a process. We have sufficient laws to prosecute crimes against life, individuals, liberty, and institutions. We are in a trance of madness grounded in fear that takes our best instincts and tries to push them into the basement or some chamber in Guantanamo within our souls. And what you're doing is bringing that power back into the light. Whether it be in your domestic missions, whether it be in Haiti, Europe, elsewhere, Asia, around the world, in liberating your soul, you are conducting a form of magic. As within, so without. Sir William Blackstone also had something to say about the wanton murders, the unchecked process of murder nationalized, murder incorporated, that we're witnessing in this Obama White House today through his Justice Department and his State Department and Central Intelligence and NSA and DIA. Blackstone said, of great importance to the public is the preservation of personal liberty. For if once it were left in the power of any, the highest magistrate to imprison, arbitrarily, whomever he or his officers thought proper, there would soon be an end of all other rights and immunities. To bereave a man of life or by violence to confiscate his estate without accusation or trial would be so gross and notorious an act of despotism as must at once convey the alarm of tyranny throughout the whole kingdom. Nor, in your brave mission, are you guaranteed your privacy. Even as we speak, the Bill of Rights protection to, well, the First Amendment, the right of free assembly, right of due process, privacy, and so on. These are being electronically shorted out by such naive mechanisms, well, not naive to the creators, but to the users, such as Facebook, which is a black hole, a permanent investigation that is being and will be shared with the government, sometimes without your notice. There is another insidious virus in virtually every commercial and internet process you go through. Whenever you watch a movie or see animations on a website, there is a monopoly from Adobe Corporation called Flash. It's an animating and media controlling program. Flash infests your browser and internet records with permanent cookies that defy what purport to be fair usage abilities to opt out or to delete cookies. It has a little back door and a tunnel that gives them another name and recreates them every few minutes. And it takes quite a bit of scrutiny to defeat that process. This is not informed consent. And if that were not enough, at the major junctions of the backbones of the internet distribution system throughout the United States, there are parallel processors operated by the NSA, the National Security Agency, getting a duplicate copy of your transmissions and analyzing them in Fort Meade, a place with so many computers you can see it hot infrared from a satellite. What are the protections the government is giving you for these things? None. In fact, the FBI has invited AT&T and Verizon to bring offices into federal facilities to make it more easy to track your records. Warrantless data taps are taking place every day. So it takes a great deal of certainty, patriotism, love, and commitment to life for this great work that you're doing. And I salute you in that work for the true American peace. Give yourselves another hand. I say, and I talk to a lot of people, you are not alone in these noble missions of peace in which you are engaged. Right now, today, at Wall Street, and now Washington Square, D.C., L.A., San Francisco, Chicago, Detroit, and 1,000 cities around this country, people are standing with you. So you will be traveling well. And as you travel in the ways of peace, as traveling men and women of peace, you should be secure in the knowledge that others of us will be here, not holding down the fort, but tearing it down. We are going to tear down that fortress of illegal American war, murder, and greed. And we're going to build a living monument to world peace and domestic freedom and a return to the rule of constitutional law. And for that, I thank you.
Stance again. He who fights and run away, live to fight another day. At the healing back day, want to catch up with the healing back day. Want to walk at the healing back day, want to catch up with the healing back day. Want to walk.
talk is cheap. Put the heart of the battle, come the sweet touch of victory. And the healing back then, come the water.
On behalf of the Coalition and WBAI, I'm Robert Knight in New York, inviting you to stay tuned for some extraordinary musical program, including Pete Seeger.
A time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant, a time to reap, a time to kill, a time to heal, a time to laugh, a time to weep, sing harmony to everything. There is a season, and a time for every purpose. A time to build up, a time to break down, a time to dance, a time to mourn, a time to cast away stones, a time to gather stones together. To everything turn, and a time for every purpose under. A time of love, a time of hate, a time of war, a time of peace, a time you may embrace, a time to refrain from embracing everything. And a time for every purpose under heaven. A time of duress, a time to gain, a time to lose, a time to rend, a time to sow, a time of love, a time of hate, a time of peace. I
swear it's not too late.
To everything,
time.
There is a season, turn. And a time for every purpose under heaven.
Way back over 50 years ago when I put this song together, I had to rearrange the words in the Bible a little because they didn't all rhyme. But my wife said, we had two children then, age 6 and age 8, she says, "You ought to have some verses for children." Well, I said, "Why don't you make them up?" And just this year, I found it was fun to sing them. A time for work,
a time for play, a time for night, a time for day, a time to sleep, a time to wake, a time for candles on the cake. A time for every purpose under heaven. That second verse. A time to get, a time to give, a time to remember, a time to forgive. A time to hug, a time to kiss, a time to close your eyes and wish to everything turn, turn, turn. There is a season, turn, turn, turn. Now we have some wonderful musicians up on the stage. Want to play? Play a verse. A time to fuss, cry, and make a fuss. A time to leave and catch the bus. A time for quiet, a time for talk. A time to run, a time to that's time for every purpose, a time for heaven. Now this is for all children to remember. A time to dress, a time to eat, a time to sit and rest your feet, a time to teach, a time to learn, a time for all to take their turn, to everything turn, turn, turn. There is a season, turn, turn, turn. And a time for every purpose under heaven. A time for dirt, a time for soap, a time for tears, a time for hope, a time for fall, a time for spring, a time to hear the robins sing. And a time for every purpose under heaven. Oh, I want to hear more harmony to everything. Turn, 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 turn.
as our season turns and turns, and the time for every purpose under heaven.
I found that a song I put together 54 years ago, I hadn't sung it much, and I came across it in a book I'd put together of my songs, and I started singing. I found it was a lot better song than I realized. Dawn. This thought keeps me moving on. If we could heed these early warnings, the time is now, quite early morning. If we could heed, sing it, these early warnings, the time is now. The time is now, quite early morning, quite early morning. Some say that humankind won't long endure, but what makes them feel so doggone sure? I know that you, who hear my singing, could make those freedom bells go ringing. I know that you who hear my singing, who hear my singing, could make those freedom bells go ringing. And so we keep on while we live, until we have no more to give. And when these fingers can strum no longer, and the old banjo too young, one stronger, when we feel can no longer, and the old banjo young one stronger. Joy and sorrow.
we still can have, we still can have. Singing tomorrows, singing tomorrows, sing it again through all this world. A joy and a sorrow, get the harmony, we sing at. Singing tomorrow, sing it again through all this world. A joy and sorrow, we still can sing tomorrow one more time through all this world. Now the joy and sorrow, we sit. The words of this song were written by one of the two geniuses I knew in my life. One was Woody Guthrie, and the other was the man who sang bass in the Weavers, Lee Hayes. His father was a Methodist preacher, but he was in Vaga. He became a lefty during the Depression. He was singing in black churches and white churches, all in the state of Arkansas. And he knew many old gospel songs, just changed one word, and they had a new verse. So he sent me a song with four verses almost the same, except they changed just one or two words. I put a tune to it, but it wasn't that good a tune. Peter, Paul, and Mary improved my tune. And then the song went around the world. If I had a hammer, I'd hammer it more. I'd hammer it all over this land. Danger, a hammer out of danger. Warning, hammer out a warning. Whoa.
I hammer out the love of my people, my brothers and my sisters, all over this land.
If I had a bell, if I had a bell, ring it,
I'd ring it in the morning, I'd ring it in the evening, all over this land.
Danger!
I ring about chase.
Warning!
I ring about warning.
Oh!
I ring about the love between my brothers and my sisters all over this land.
If I had a song,
if I had a song,
sing it,
I'd sing it in the morning. I'd sing it in the evening, all over this land.
Danger!
I'd sing up just I'd sing up a warning. I'd sing about love between my brothers and my sisters.
Well, I got a hammer.
I got a hammer.
A bell.
And I've got a bell.
A song.
And I've got a song to sing.
Sing
all over this land.
It's the hammer of justice. freedom.
It's the bell of freedom.
Love.
It's the song about love between my brothers and my sisters.
You know, the people with money can break up any big thing they want. But what are they going to do about millions of little things? And this gathering today is just the beginning of gardens all through New York and other towns. The little town I live in, 60 miles north, was put together 300 years ago by a 16-year-old Dutch girl who married an English captain. And he found she had a piece of paper saying that because her father had given money here and given money there, she had 20,000 acres on the side of the Hudson. And her husband says, let's go up there and we can sell the land to farmers. They went up there and they made a deal with the Indians. They'd only sell land in the valley. It was a big triangle. The Hudson was one side, the mountains going northeast was another side, and they surveyed a straight line from the Hudson over to the mountains. And they built a little house because there was a waterfall there. And they had a big stone made with grooves in it so they could grind corn. And then the sailboat they had was probably 30 or 40 feet, not a great big one like the Clearwater, which is 75 feet on deck. But it was, they had brought the stone up there. The man, Captain Brett, was looking one direction and the wind shifted just a little and caught the rear corner of the sail and it whipped across, hit him in the back of the head, knocks him in the water and he drowns. Now this Dutch girl had, they had three little kids, I think none of them, all under four. And I'm sure her family and maybe his thought she'd give up this ambitious project. But I call it the tugboat Annie syndrome. The husband dies, the wife says, I can do this job. And for 50 more years she lived. She got on horseback. Oh, she got other women to take care of the babies. And she got on horseback and went around with surveyors. Let's sell a farm here. Let's sell a farm there. And she made deals with people who didn't have enough money they could pay over time. And they called her Madame Brett. Her house still stands right near Main Street in the little town of Beacon. Although there were originally two towns, the waterfall they called Mattawan because in the Delaware Indian language, Mattawan means place of rushing waters. And then that town grew first. Then they put in a railroad in 1847, and now the river part. And a straight line between the two got called Main Street. And the two towns grew closer and closer and closer till exactly 100 years ago this year, they said, this is silly to have two towns. And they became one town and called it Beacon after the mountain. Because George Washington had said, they ought to have a beacon on top of that mountain to help guide the ships. Of course, in those days, a beacon, one man had to live up there and gather dry wood, chop it, saw it, And then when nighttime came, he lit a fire, and you could see this fire miles and miles away. That's what a beacon was 200 years ago, just a mere 200 years ago. Well, now, if we do our job right, 200 years from now, they will look back to this day when you showed people how planting gardens will bring people together.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and you've been listening to a mayoral forum and Pete Seeger concert convened at Cooper Union by the New York City Community Garden Coalition at nyccgc.org. Today's program was recorded and produced by Linda Perry of WBAI News, with engineering by Michael G. Haskins and Reggie Johnson.
Speech, but we all talking at the same time. We say we want peace, but nobody wants to change their own mind. Goes on and on and on and on and on for 1,000 years. 1,000 years, I say. And it goes on and on and on and on and on. What language are your tears? Are your tears? Everybody wants to live life of kings and queens, but nobody wants to stay and plow the fields. Everybody wants to tell their neighbors how to live, but nobody wants to listen to how they feel. So it goes on and on and on and on and on for 1,000 years. 1,000 years, I say. And it goes on and on and on and on and on. Your language are your tears, are your tears. But what I got to say right now is love enough, yeah, love enough, yeah, love enough. Or can you love some more? Is the love enough? Yeah.
The music credits for today's program are the opening theme, The Bell for Freedom by Stevie Wonder, The Times They Are A-Changing by Odetta, The Heathens by Bob Marley, and Is Love Enough by Michael Franti and Spearhead.
Can you love some more? It goes on and on, on and on, and on. For 1,000 years, I say.
Hi, Paul Fisher from WBAI Then and WBAI Now. Tired of pesky programs interrupting our fascinating fundraising drives? No problem, don't touch that dial. We can sell you conspiracies and miracle cures till the sun goes supernova. Or you can help WBAI again become a station known for programs, not just products. How? Thought you'd never ask. Become a BAI buddy. That's a minimum $10 a month donation for each of the next 12 months. Help end the heartbreak of psoriasis cures and other lotions, potions, and nostrums sold on the radio by sending us money to make radio. Go to WBAI.org, our website, and become a WBAI buddy.
Well, I don't know if I'm walking on solid ground.
Why doesn't it come? Why doesn't it come?
Were you waiting for me, Dan Malley?
Who's that? Who spoke?
The Shadow.
The Shadow?
There isn't much time, Malley. They're coming after you to take you to the chair. Speak quickly. What have you to say?
Just this. For the best in old-time radio thrills, adventure, and comedy, tune in to the Golden Age of Radio, 7 to 9, Sunday nights, right here on WBAI New York.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a Wednesday night program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. Well, how many times have you heard me say, we're going to have a Sheckley story this morning? We're going to have a Sheckley story this morning. I'm not even going to say which Sheckley or Courtney. Just stay tuned.
Hour of the Wolf movie review, air date April 3rd, 2014. Noah, take one. I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. And let's start off with a bit of housekeeping, shall we? Last week in my review of Divergent, our host Jim Freund got on my butt for pronouncing the word erudite as erudite. He was right, of course, no arguments there. But in my defense, I should point out that the characters in the film all pronounce the word as erudite, and I was just following suit. That said, I should also note that if there was a faction in the film that was referred to as the nuclear, I would have done the same, yeah, but also probably would have pointed out the error. Just boils down to this was a case where everybody was jumping off the cliff, and I was standing at the edge peering cautiously over and thinking, maybe they know something I don't. I should have more confidence in my own instincts, that's all.
And I'm going to pause Dan's review to say, and I didn't listen to it earlier, that I was rewatching a Ken Burns documentary, the jazz one, in which the announcer, and these people are very, very careful, the narrator said, erudite. I don't know. I think I'm right. And I checked every pronunciation guide in the world, and they all say erudite. And yet. So I'm off Dan's case on that.
Okay, enough of that. Let's think about something we probably haven't thought about before. Let's think about the moments immediately after Noah and his family seal the doors of their ark and cast off as the tumultuous rains fall and the waters rise. You know, the moments where our heroes are sitting there and listening as all of humanity is being exterminated outside. A key moment in Darren Aronofsky's Noah captures just that notion, the camera focusing in on the face of Russell Crowe as he plays the man both certain of what his Lord has asked him to do and tortured by its implications. It's a moment of no little horror and serves as a dividing line between the two neatly integrated films that Noah is, a vivid and visionary fantasy keyed off the classic Bible tale and a deeper inquest into questions of faith and mercy and the nature of humanity itself. A bit of a personal note here. It's been a rough few months, and it's taken a lot out of me emotionally. In addition, I had by necessity taken a few weeks off from movie going, and when I finally returned, it was to Divergent, of all things. I came out of that mess fearing that I'd lost all joy in the practice of watching movies, that I'd essentially lost one of my reasons for living. Noah, happily, has restored my faith in cinema. Exciting, moving, entertaining things are still possible, and I shouldn't be surprised that Darren Aronofsky was the man to help prove it. His work hasn't always sat well with me, but even when it didn't, I respected his commitment to his vision and didn't regret being given a glimpse into what stirred his soul. With Noah, Aronofsky makes a concerted move towards the mainstream, but on his own terms. The first two acts, comprising the introduction to Noah and his family, the vision that reveals the Lord's judgment on humanity, and the building of the ark and the assembling of the animals, plays like the kind of epic fantasy we've been seeing in the past few years. The world as envisioned here is not the historic one of biblical times, but a fantastic realm where fallen angels take the form of lumbering rock monsters, forests sprout from the wilderness at God's behest, where Anthony Hopkins' Methuselah is part canny grandpa, part vision-inducing shaman, and where humanity's degeneracy is personified in Ray Winstone's shrewd, embittered leader Tubal Cain. All this may be a deconstruction of present-day mainstream historic fantasy, but it also harkens back to more classic examples of the genre. In many ways, Noah is to the Bible what Jason and the Argonauts was to Greek mythology, all the way down to CG animated sequences that deliberately have the strobing look of classic Ray Harryhausen animation. At the same time Aronofsky is hitting the traditional mainstream beats, he's not derelict in setting up the themes that will become crucial in the film's final act. God's directives, conveyed to Noah through complex and beautiful montages of imagery, contain ambiguities that form the final stages of the prophet's narrative arc. In Aronofsky's debut film, Pi, the director demonstrated a fascination for Jewish mysticism and biblical scholarship that he puts to work here, turning the film in its final act from the spectacle that preceded it into a drama of a man trying to interpret God's intentions from what, at best, is incomplete evidence. I suspect it's this final drama and how it affects Noah's relationship to the rest of his family that was Aronofsky's true reason for making this film. It's also, by the way, the moment that Noah's wife, Nama, as portrayed by Jennifer Connelly, comes into her own in opposition to her husband and his notion of God's will. But as powerful as the final act is, it does in some way bump up awkwardly against the scope and vividness of what precedes it, and isn't helped by the addition of a character who seems to be thrown in so there could be a suitably kick-butt finale within the drama. Even so, that isn't enough to diminish my enthusiasm for this film. It's a truly amazing work of fantastic filmmaking, imaginative with a core of dramatic depth, entertaining while being a truly personal statement. It is, all told, the first great film of 2014. I'm Dan Persons. If you love science fiction, fantasy, and horror film, please check out Cinefantastique Online at cfqonline.com.
A fellow by the name of Noah built an ark. Everybody knows he built an ark. He said, what did Noah do? He said, well, he built an ark. But very few people know about the conversation that went on between the Lord and Noah. You see, Noah was in his rec room sawing away. He was making a few things for the home there. He's a good carpenter. Vuba, 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 vuba. Noah. Somebody call? Vuba, vuba, vuba. Noah. Who is that? It's the Lord, Noah. Right. Where I am? What do you want? I've been good. I want you to build an ark. Right. What's an ark? Get some wood, build it 300 cubits by 80 cubits by 40 cubits. Right. What's a cubit? Let's see, a cubit. I used to know what a cubit was. Well, don't worry about that, Noah. When you get that done, go out into the world, collect all of the animals in the world by twos, male and female, and put them into the ark. Right. Who is this really? What's going on? How come you want me to do all these weird things? I'm going to destroy the world. Right. Am I on candid camera? How are you going to do it? I'm going to make it rain 4,000 days and drown them right out. Right. Listen to this, you'll save water. Let it rain for 40 days and 40 nights and wait for the sewers to back up. Right.
Broken windows. hold.